Question one, whether to allow religious and philosophical vaccination exemptions for students. In May of last year, the legislature passed a new law tightening the vaccination rules for students of schools and colleges and for employees of healthcare facilities. No longer would parents be able to claim a religious or philosophical objection to vaccinations. The only non-vaccinated students who would be allowed to attend school would be those with a validated medical exemption. The law came after a drop in Maine's vaccination rates, especially in some communities, and after diseases such as whooping cough began to rise. Almost immediately, opponents of the new law began a referendum campaign to overturn it. They succeeded in collecting enough signatures, and voters will decide on the measure next week. I'm Jennifer Rooks, today on Maine Calling, understanding question one on the statewide ballot. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As the primary election draws near, you have probably seen the signs everywhere for yes or no on question one. The ballot referendum centers on vaccination exemptions for students. Today, we will discuss the issues raised by both sides. Joining me today, Dr. Laura Blaisdell, a pediatrician with Maine Families for Vaccines, representing No on One, and Kara Sachs, a clinical social worker and co-chair for the Yes on One campaign. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you looking for clarification on what question one means? Do you have questions about the efficacy of vaccinations, about the details of the law? You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Laura and Kara, thank you both so much for being here. Before we go to you, though, we have two of Maine Public's reporters joining us now. My colleagues Patty White and Steve Missler have been covering question one. Steve, I'll start with you. The wording on the ballot question is confusing. They often are. This aims to repeal a change passed by the legislature last session. Steve, can you lay out what the referendum would do?
Sure. I think the ballot question is relatively clear, but it's a people's veto referendum, and so those are inherently a little counterintuitive. But to the question itself, so for many years, there were three types of exemptions parents could get if they didn't want to vaccinate their school-age children. But last year, Maine joined a host of other states in seeking to pare back those exemptions because there was a concern that once eradicated diseases were making a comeback and because so many people are opting out of vaccines. So the legislature went ahead and passed a bill that repealed two of those exemptions, one's for philosophical reasons, the other for religious reasons. And it left in place exemptions for medical reasons. Now, a group of activists immediately opposed that law and went about using what we call a people's veto in Maine. And now they were successful in getting that on the ballot. And they're basically making the argument that that new law infringes on parental rights. So when voters go to the polls next Tuesday, a yes vote will mean repealing the new law and keeping all of the old exemptions, and a no vote will uphold the new law, which wouldn't actually go into effect until 2021.
Patty, in Maine, there has been a decrease in vaccination rates in some communities. And my understanding is that that is in large part what the legislature was responding to. So what is the very latest? What do we know about vaccination rates in Maine? And are we seeing outbreaks of diseases that people can be vaccinated against?
Sure. So what we know from State Center for Disease Control data is that immunization rates have been declining in recent years. Last year, with the exception of the chickenpox vaccine, immunization rates dipped below 95% in kindergartners. And at the same time, the non-medical exemption rate has increased to 5.6%, and that's more than double the national average. And in terms of outbreaks, Maine does have, in 2019, had the second highest rate of pertussis, and the highest rates were in Hancock and Waldo counties.
And Hancock and Waldo County also had a high vaccination exemption rate, correct?
I'm not sure. I would have to look at the map again, but they had among the highest rates of pertussis.
Okay, so Patty, how does Maine's current law compare to other states?
So there are four other states who have laws that prohibit non-medical exemptions. That's been the case for a while in Mississippi and West Virginia. And then more recently, California and New York passed laws. And those were in response to outbreaks of measles. People may remember 5 years ago, there was a measles outbreak in California linked to Disneyland. And then partway through 2018, a measles outbreak started in New York, which lasted for about a year. Then other states also have looked at different types of legislation that don't outright ban these non-medical exemptions, but look to just make it more difficult to get a non-medical exemption.
Okay, Patty, both sides in this debate say that they want to protect children. And even though every major medical organization says vaccines are safe and effective, some children experience side effects. In fact, when all of us take our children to the doctor for vaccinations, we're handed a piece of paper with contact information for the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. How does the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program work, and what do we know about the actual injury rate from vaccinations?
So the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was established in the late 80s, and it's designed to operate outside the traditional court system to allow people who have experienced a side effect from a vaccine to have a more efficient resolution if they bring forward a claim. And over the lifetime of the program, about 30 years, it has paid out about $4 billion in compensation. According to the federal agency that oversees it, about 70% of the cases that do receive a payout are a result of negotiated settlements, and there is not a conclusion that a vaccine caused an injury. And that, just to provide a little bit more context, in the past decade or so, about 4,500 claims have been paid out. And in the same time, there have been 3.5 billion doses of vaccine. And what that amounts to is that one person receives compensation for about every 750,000 doses of vaccine that are distributed.
So, yeah, and the math I did was one for every 777,000. It's a little more than that. Yeah. Steve, as a political reporter, what strikes you about this referendum?
Well, I guess the first thing is that this is not your typical Democrat versus Republican issue, and not by a long shot. And that makes it hard to say how it will all shake out next week. I mean, this is one of those issues that creates this sort of odd nexus of political views. And that's especially true for the yes side, where you have religious conservatives, libertarians, and in some cases, liberals coming out together to oppose this new vaccination law. Now, one might think that a bill that passes a Democratic-controlled legislature and was signed by a Democratic governor would probably be safe from a people's veto election that occurs alongside a Democratic presidential primary, which is the case next week. But I'm not so sure about that. I mean, a lot of the donations coming to the yes side were from traditional liberal strongholds in this state. So it'll be really interesting to see, how that all, comes to play on Tuesday.
All right. Well, Steve Missler and Patty White, thank you so much for joining us to add some context to this program today. And now we're going to turn to our other guests in the studio. And we're going to start with you, Kara, because this is how we start. You are part of the group that introduced the referendum. Why, in your view, is this referendum necessary?
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having us today. We were a really organic grassroots group that formed throughout the legislative process and felt that it was really important to take on this people's veto and bring this to a vote of the people. We did not see the evidence of decline in rates. We did not see a need for the bill, and we did not see any documentation that this law would solve that problem if it were to exist. We did see what we feel across the country is definitely the influence of the pharmaceutical industry in pushing mandates to remove parents' rights. And so we feel that it's really important that there's no documentation to support a need to remove parents' rights and individuals' rights to make their own medical decisions, and that should never be done in exchange for education.
All right, Laura, why is this not a matter of parents' rights?
Ultimately, parents get to decide whether or not they vaccinate their children. However, when we share communal spaces like schools, our choices affect others. When we look at the Maine CDC rates for non-medical opt-outs, they have been increasing every year by 0.5%. Unfortunately, the prior laws were fine until we've reached this level now that we're below the 95% protection of community immunity. That's not debatable. We are below that. In fact, 14 out of 16 counties in Maine have MMR rates that are below that level. And over 40% of elementary schools have vaccination rates below 85%. That's alarming as a pediatrician, as a public health trained pediatrician, because that puts our schools at risk. And indeed, if they were at risk, we would see outbreaks. And we have. There have been outbreaks of whooping cough. There have been outbreaks of chickenpox. And those, like myself in the medical community, have joined together in a coalition of over 60 healthcare organizations and medical groups that represent everyone from the Maine Medical Association, which is 4,800 physicians. This is an unprecedented coalition. It's joined by Northern Light Health. It's joined by Mercy. It's joined by Maine Health. It's joined by Maine's pediatricians and family practitioners. It's joined by Maine school nurses. We're the individuals who watch these rates and have been alarmed by the outbreaks in our schools and that these dangerous diseases are coming back. And that's why we're urging a no vote on one.
Kara, are you not concerned about the herd immunity rate falling?
We feel that we haven't seen the documentation to support that. I hear a lot that the rates are declining. And in Maine, we have really excellent school nurses who do a really great job of collecting data. And so when you're looking at the vaccination rate versus the exemption rate, it's an average rounded up 95% vaccination rate. For the last school year, it's 94.7%. So we're talking about, you know, a percentage of a percent decrease. I'd also like to point out that that data actually wasn't even released that showed any decline until after the bill was already printed and after the work session was already heard in the legislature. And there were key components that were left out of the CDC's measures that changed the rates. And so overall, we've really seen, you know, starting in 2000, our rates were in the 80s, and our rates have been hovering between, you know, 94.5% and 96.5%. Since about 2010. So we really don't see that decline.
We're talking about a statewide rate, though. There are pockets in Maine where the rate is much lower, correct?
Yes. And we saw that in the legislative session, and we looked at a lot of the pockets. And in Maine, you know, there are small schools. So in some cases, that accounts for one child in a class who's missing one dose of one vaccine, and that drives the rate down. But we would certainly argue, and we feel public health is absolutely important, that this bill is not a middle ground. It is a mandate. Parents in Maine cannot afford to stay home to homeschool. They cannot afford to stay home and not send their kids to daycare. You're really forcing and coercing parents into agreeing, and often it's one dose. And so, you know, there was no middle ground that was even entertained to try to work on those pockets and bring that rate up voluntarily, if that's the concern.
And Laura, let me ask you about that. How, when we are looking at these vaccination rates of non-vaccination or not being up to what the schedule ought to be, how many of these children are completely unvaccinated and how many of them have not maybe missed one dose or two doses or not completely up to date?
You know, it's unclear from the data exactly whether or not kids are partially immunized or are fully unimmunized. But I think the important thing is that in either of those cases, outbreaks of these diseases are happening in our schools. When we have children with cancer or children in immunocompromised states or children who can't receive immunizations for a particular reason and they are going to school, their parents have a right to send them to a safe school. And if we have a safe and effective way of keeping our schools protected, then we have a right, we have an obligation as a medical community and in the public health to make sure our schools are safe. You know, this parents in Maine and in the U.S. have the right to not vaccinate their child. They simply do not have the right to put other children at risk by their decisions.
All right. Well, we're talking about Yes on One, which is on next Tuesday's ballot. Lots and lots of questions already in. If you would like to join those, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from MEMIC. who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com. The Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at JoeBornstein.com. And AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME.
Michael Bloomberg says he's the best candidate for president because when he was mayor of New York, he kept his city safe. But at what cost?
We adopted a policy which had been in place, the policy that all big police departments use of stop and frisk. What happened, however, was it got out of control.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the legacy of stop and frisk this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Do you watch Maine Public Television? Do you receive an over-the-air signal rather than cable or satellite? And do you watch in Southern Maine and watch Channel 26 out of Biddeford? If you answered yes to those questions, this official heads up is for you. Due to the need to make a mandatory technical adjustment on March 11th, you will have to rescan your television in order to be able to continue to watch Channel 26 over the air in Southern Maine. It's a simple process, but very important. We'll keep you posted, but for more information on how to rescan your television, please visit mainpublic.org and click on the television dropdown for Television Rescan Day.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Question 1, the ballot referendum on vaccination exemptions. My guests today, Kara Sachs, representing Yes on 1, and Dr. Laura Blaisdell, representing No on 1. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start in Machias with Eleanor. Hi, Eleanor. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm calling as the mother of a vaccinated immunocompromised child. He is missing only the booster to the vaccine that he has reacted to, which is recorded in his medical record. He also has received treatments like IVIG in the past, and yet he still does not qualify for a medical exemption in the state of Maine. And this is something I've been searching and fighting for now for over 10 years since he was hospitalized. I would like to ask the doctor how she can guarantee that with this new law, he will be safe and he will be able to be educated further in the state of Maine.
Laura, thank you so much, Eleanor, for your question. What does the new law say about medical exemptions?
I thank Eleanor for her question because it's a very important point. There are children who should not receive vaccinations. And under the previous law, I, as a physician, was limited to a very finite list of reasons why I could give a medical exemption to a patient of mine like Eleanor's child. This new law widens medical exemptions. It widens them to not only MDs and DOs, but to nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, and thankfully has finally freed physicians to give medical exemptions if it's under their best medical advice. So I really appreciate and look forward to when this new law is enacted, because it'll provide the liberty that physicians need to protect those children.
Kara.
Yeah, I'd love to jump in on that. So the story that our caller presented is one that I've unfortunately heard many, many times. And the reason the medical exemption was opened under this new law was because so many parents were telling the exact same story, that they have children who their doctors have agreed should not be vaccinated. And then the doctor has also said that they're unable to give them a medical exemption now since the law has passed. And I think the culture that we're living in of the pharmaceutical industry driving these mandates across the country, we've seen in other states that they come in and crack down on the doctors next, and doctors are penalized for writing medical exemptions. And so I do appreciate, and I think obviously there's a genuine need and desire to protect these kids, but I think in the reality of this law, it does not do that. It actually puts those children at risk and will exclude them from school because they cannot obtain that medical exemption.
Okay, Laura, I'm going to let you reply to that the pharmaceutical companies driving what the doctors are doing and whether or not doctors are providing exemptions. Is that true?
It's certainly not true in this case, Jennifer. My first oath that I took as a physician was to do no harm. And as a pediatrician who's seen thousands of patients, I would never, ever hurt a child knowingly because somebody was putting pressure on me. My very first oath is to do no harm. And so I am so looking forward to when this law is enacted, and I hope that people will vote no, because I want it to be enacted so that I will have the liberty as a physician to give the medical exemptions that I see fit.
All right, Eleanor, thanks so much for your call. We're going to go to Maggie calling from Portland. Hi, Maggie, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. Hi, Kara and Dr. Blaisdell. My question today is for Kara. Do you think the 60-plus medical groups, including the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, are shilling for Big Pharma, or do they care about protecting Maine's children?
I think that we all care about protecting Maine's children. And what I would note is that the coalition that is supporting No-1-1 is the boards and the decision makers at those medical groups. It does not represent all of the individual physicians and employees. They did not vote to come out and decide to be No-1-1. And in fact, we have many of those providers who have volunteered, who collected signatures, and who support maintaining the parents' right to decide. Just as my opponent had said last night, you know, not wanting the government to control medical decisions being made in her practice, not wanting the government to control those decisions that parents are making.
And when you're referring to last night, you're referring to a television debate that was last night that I suspect many of our listeners have not seen. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say that when medical organizations, healthcare organizations, when every single hospital in the state of Maine comes out to oppose this referendum, it means something. And as the vice president of the Maine American Academy of Pediatrics, I know that we represent every single pediatrician in Maine. And pediatricians are, frankly, at the center of this debate. We are the trusted go-to source of information for patients. We've given thousands and thousands of vaccines. And we're the ones who are getting called about, you know, pertussis or whooping cough, or my child has a rash and I'm worried that it's measles, which has made a horrible comeback in the U.S. because of declining vaccination rates. So, yes, in many of these cases, it is the organization and its members who are standing up to say No-1-1.
And Kara, are you doubting that? Are you saying that there are pediatricians who are opposed to this?
Absolutely. And there are pediatricians who feel, I think that's a completely false statement. There are pediatricians that feel that vaccination is important and that that should be made individually between the doctor and the patient, and the state should not be dictating that relationship.
Okay. I haven't heard that, but okay. Being on the board of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Maggie, thank you so much for your call. A question here from Lorraine. When my children were babies, there was a lot of seemingly credible information that vaccines came with serious risks. I had a friend whose baby had seizures after a vaccination. I talked with our family doctor, and we agreed to an altered vaccination schedule, starting with vaccines for diseases that are in Maine. So they only received the DTaP for the first years of life. Now that some of the risks have been proven to be untrue, and my kids have not had bad reactions to vaccinations they've received, we're trying to catch up. This process is not easy because there doesn't seem to be any advice about schedule or timing for catching up. Because we didn't start with a schedule when my kiddos were babies, I am now responsible for figuring out a healthy schedule. I am not a doctor. With this law, my family is in the gray. I am not in one camp or the other. I want children without healthy immune systems to be able to go to school, and I want my children to be able to go to schools. Does the law include measures or a plan for unvaccinated children to be vaccinated at a schedule that works for the family and their doctor? And do we get credit for slowly catching up, or will my children not be allowed to go to school if we are not fully caught up by a specific date?
So one thing that I really am happy about this law is that by age five, when most children go to kindergarten, they need to be vaccinated against eight dangerous and deadly diseases. And it allows pediatricians like myself to continue to work with families to get them on a schedule that's agreeable to the both of us. Now, how the regulation will come out about whether or not children need to be vaccinated on day one, or whether they'll be have an opportunity to catch up slowly over that first year, I'm unclear at too as a pediatrician. But I'm very grateful that I'll be able to continue to work with families and create vaccination schedules that are acceptable to the both of us in terms of the child's risk.
Yeah, a lot of families have had very strong concerns about this. The Maine CDC, as I mentioned, was unable to answer really basic questions, as Dr. Blaisdell had referred to earlier about, you know, who makes up that exemption rate. They don't keep the data. There's a lot of data missing, and we have reached out to the CDC to ask about catch-up schedules for children that fall into that camp, and they say they don't have any information. And so I think it really comes down to, for us on the yes on one side, really poor implementation where there's no plan in place. A lot of the schools don't even know when the law goes into place, and they're not taking into account that it puts parents potentially in a dangerous situation to try to get caught up.
And the law would go into effect when, Laura?
In September of 2021. And I believe the CDC is waiting prudently to see what happens when the outcome of March 3rd before they try to roll out regulations. And you know, I do think that there are some really clear data. The clear data is that our immunization rates are below a level that's going to protect our schools.
So if no succeeds and the law goes into place between now and September of 2021, is that enough time for most unvaccinated kids to catch up? Carrie, you're shaking your head no.
Actually, it is. And I know that it is because I worked with the legislators. I was asked how long would it take for a fully unvaccinated child to be fully vaccinated by day one of kindergarten. The longest of the vaccine series to catch up on is the DTaP series. That would take about 14 months to catch up on. And so I really encourage legislators to delay the rollout of this bill, because we do need to figure out, like Kara said, there are a lot of questions about how to implement this bill, but one of them isn't if a child will have an opportunity to be fully caught up by the time of kindergarten.
And Kara, you're shaking your head. You don't believe that's enough time?
We have parents, as I said, that have talked with their pediatricians. They are really unsure about, especially if you have a child who hasn't received vaccines, it's different. And I'd like to really clarify that exemption rate, it is many children who are missing one dose of one vaccine.
So they'll have time.
They will absolutely have time. Children that are missing multiple doses, it's a decision for the parents. You have a lot of parents that want to space out vaccines. And so it potentially puts parents in a difficult time crunch.
I think one other thing that's important to note is that that we do have clear catch-up schedules for kids, and they're often much more delayed than the standard schedules. So we do have clear guidance on how to help these families, and I believe we'll be able to answer that.
An email from Selena. Why aren't teachers being required to be fully up to date on all vaccinations? If the goal is to make schools safe from the disease, it doesn't make sense to me why no one's talking about all the adults in a school and whether or not they are up to date. And yet missing one dose of a vaccine is enough to keep a student out of school?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a great question. And it goes back to the implementation of the law, and this being a law that really we feel in the yes on one side does not advance public health, because it's not looking at titer levels. So you don't know who's actually immune to a disease in the class. It doesn't account for adults that are in the class. Those adults do not have to provide vaccination rates. They do not have to be up to date, and most adults are not. And it similarly doesn't include, you know, visitors, concerts, sports activities. So children who would be removed from school under this law for missing even one dose of a vaccine can come to spectate a sport and be there in the school building, but they can't participate in the sport. Doesn't make sense.
We do have a lot of questions to answer with this law. You know, our school immunization rates dropping below 95%, below the community immunity rates for these dangerous diseases, is a new issue for Maine. And so we're going to have to address all of those who are at risk in the school settings. You know, there are teachers who also cannot be vaccinated, and they deserve to teach in a safe environment as well. So there are issues that we're going to have to work out with. I work out, and I really look forward to ironing that out when hopefully the no on one side wins.
Okay, so we'll go to Ann, who's calling from North Yarmouth. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. And hello, Dr. Brazel and Kara. Kara, I have a question for you. If your child had cancer, which decreased his or her ability to fight disease, would you want them to attend school with a child who has whooping cough or measles?
I absolutely would not want them to attend school with a child who had an active disease. And I worked in the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia with many parents who have children that are immunocompromised and cancer. And I know how difficult and heartbreaking that is. I also know that our schools are really probably one of the worst places for those kids because of the frequency of common colds, bugs. We incentivize attendance. We have teachers that can't miss work. So I think the likelihood that a child is coming in contact with one of those diseases from an unvaccinated child, the likelihood is extremely low, and that's where I differ on the issue.
This is really, frankly, the center of the issue, is that our schools aren't safe for children who are immunocompromised, who have cancer, who are on life-saving immunosuppressive drugs. And that's been bared out. I think we've seen some really great reports in the news about this. And when we're thinking about these children and their parents' right to put them on a school bus to send them to a safe school, that's really the central issue here. And that's why we're urging people, and the medical communities and the healthcare communities in Maine are urging people to vote no on one. It's just too dangerous to repeal this law.
And thanks for your call. A tweet from Chris. I was lied to by a person collecting signatures at the farmers market this past fall and signed their petition. I am a no voter and was duped. A number of friends had the same thing happen to them. Can the yes person explain mm-hmm. this tactic? I guess, Kara, that's you. You're the yes person.
Yes, I am. So we had about 800 volunteers out collecting signatures this summer. We had a small percentage of signatures collected by paid gatherers. And as we understand it, the Secretary of State already came out on this issue and said that this happens with every referendum. And they had received about 6 or 7 complaints. The questions, as we know, are very confusing. And our signature gatherers absolutely did not attempt to deceive anyone. Most signers were asked, there's been a very large change to the vaccination law in Maine. And do you agree, will you sign so that the people of Maine can vote yes or no?
An email from Meredith. Why is either side not taking the moderate approach of arguing that only certain vaccinations or two need to fall under this new law? The problem is that vaccinations are all being talked about like they're the same. This would be a much more reasonable conversation if each vaccination was reviewed individually. Laura, do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. The vaccines that we're asking children to be protected with when they enter school are 8 diseases. This is certainly not the full vaccine schedule that we would recommend for families, but these are the diseases that are the most communicable, the most dangerous, and they're the ones that we're starting to see on a rise. We're seeing the rise of measles, so we should probably ask our children to be protected from that. We're seeing rises of chickenpox in our schools, so that's why we're asking people to be protected from that. So, Meredith, you're absolutely correct. Not every disease needs to be controlled by vaccination in our school settings, because not every disease is so vastly and virulently communicable. So we're asking Mainers to vaccinate their children as a condition of school entry for certain diseases that we can't control without vaccination.
And Laura, would you, Kara, would you be more comfortable if this were 1 or 2 vaccinations and not 8?
We absolutely attempted many middle grounds to try to work on education, to try to increase reporting so we really understood what that statistic looked like. I think it's a great question. Do we have an exemption issue with only 1 vaccine that most parents are skipping 1 dose that we could work on? And that never happened. And I just do want to clarify for the listeners, this law applies to daycare as well. And there are many more vaccines that are required for daycare entry, including Hep B, which a lot of parents delay. And so under this law, a lot of parents will not be able to access daycare in Maine.
Jennifer, may I make a comment?
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of conversation about what a middle ground option would look like. I, as a pediatrician, have been doing this. I've been practicing in Maine for 15 years. I am a public health trained pediatrician. I and the coalition of over 60 healthcare organizations have been working on this issue for decades. We have been working to educate our patients. We have been working to educate our communities. And what has happened? What has happened is that the non-medical opt-out rates continue to climb each year, despite those of us who have dedicated our lives to this issue. So the middle ground option, we have lost the option for a middle ground option.
All right. Well, we do need to take another quick break. So many calls coming in. Probably will not get to very many of them, but we're going to do our best. You are listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about question one, and we'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME. And MEMIC, who believes in a balanced workers' compensation system for Maine employees and employers. Learn more at MEMIC.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On February 25, 1861, the town of Washburn in Aroostook County was incorporated. The town is named after Israel Washburn, Jr., the governor of Maine at the time. Washburn was born in 1813 in Livermore to a prominent political family. He spent his life in politics and served in Congress from March 4, 1851 to January 1, 1861, when he resigned, having been elected governor. He died in 1883 and is buried at Mount Hope Cemetery in Bangor.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine.
Hello, I'm Philip Yun, host of World Affairs. Are the Hong Kong protests the biggest challenge to China's authoritarian rule in 30 years? Next on World Affairs, a conversation with leading China specialist Jeffrey Wasserstrom and Mary Kay Magstead. They introduce us to activists on the front lines of protests against Beijing's efforts to bring Hong Kong under its wing. Wasserstrom's new book is Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, question one on vaccinations. We're talking with Dr. Laura Blaisdell for No on One and Kara Sachs for Yes on One. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking about daycares. And Beth, I believe you had a question about young people in daycare.
Yeah, thank you so much. This question is kind of directed at Kara. So much focus has been on schools, but this law also mandates vaccines for, you know, daycare, preschool, and pre-K as well. And it's my understanding that there will be no room for delayed vaccination schedules for this population, including the Hep B shot that's given at birth. Could you address this? And if that is the case, it seems this bill would be extremely punitive to working mothers and single moms and women in poverty who rely on these daycare services, you know, that we're supposed to be empowering specifically as Democrats. And I find that very concerning, especially since Dr. Blaisdell said, you know, we have a lot of questions to answer about this bill and a lot of things to iron out. It doesn't feel like we should be forcing something through that has so many unanswered questions.
Okay, so you're nodding, Kara. You've heard this from other parents as well.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, we talk frequently when we're talking about this law only about K to 12 schools, but in the daycare setting, the burden of vaccines is on younger children. And so parents will not be able to use a delayed schedule unless they're able to obtain that kind of unicorn medical exemption for those reasons. And many parents, you know, fall middle of the road on this issue. It's really been portrayed as pro or anti-vaccine. Many parents choose to space out vaccines because they don't want their children to receive four or five doses at once. And so if parents want to have their child fully vaccinated by kindergarten, but they would like to space out those vaccines, they may not utilize daycare services in Maine. And we're just not a state that can afford to exclude parents in that way.
Laura, anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, you know, the burden of these illnesses on infants is great. You know, as a pediatrician who has stayed up all night trying to keep infants alive from pertussis infections. So yes, there are vaccines that we're asking infants to be vaccinated against. You know, when we create laws like this, these are laws where personal choice butts up against societal responsibility. We have plenty of laws, like our seatbelt laws, like our drunk driving laws, where you're welcome to not wear your seatbelt, or you're welcome to drink and sit in your car in your driveway, but you're not welcome to put others at risk. And that's what we're talking about here in terms of infants and daycares, as well as our schools. I think all Mainers are now realizing that these opt-out rates have what they have done to our community immunity and protection, and that we really need to do something to shore this up.
All right. Thank you, Beth, for your question. We're going to move on to Brunswick and Brandy. Hi, Brandy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, this is Brandy. I have a question for both Kara and Dr. Blaisdell, I guess. Just to review, what I'm hearing is that we're unclear about how many students in the data that's been reviewed are in fact completely unvaccinated versus partially vaccinated, maybe missing a single dose of one vaccine for the requirement. We're unclear about delayed schedules. We're unclear about the actual, this hasn't even really been addressed, the reliability rates of the vaccines. So I spent some time looking at the Maine surveillance reports for some of these diseases like pertussis, which keeps coming up. And Dr. Blaisdell keeps telling us about her credentials, but let's talk about the facts. What are the reliability rates for a vaccine like the pertussis, like the DTaP, for example? It's my understanding it's about 67% reliable at actually preventing the disease, which makes a whole demographic of children and adults who receive that vaccine still vulnerable to the infection despite having been vaccinated.
Sure, Brandy. Thanks for your question. Kara, I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, and so I think that's really the crucial point where we diverge here, because we all agree that public health is important and we want our schools to be safe. Our side, the yes on one side, really argues that there's been no documentation. It's not even arguing. The CDC said there was no case of an unvaccinated child in Maine bringing a vaccine-targeted illness into a school. And what we see is the pertussis cases, as I mentioned earlier, they're 80% fully vaccinated for pertussis. That's from the Maine CDC. We had one case of measles in Maine last year. That child was vaccinated for the disease, and that was the first Maine resident in decades. We've also had mumps outbreaks at Bates, and there's one currently at UNH, and those are all in fully vaccinated individuals. So what I'm seeing in the news, the outbreaks that are being blamed on families that might be missing only one dose of vaccine, those are actually occurring in people who are vaccinated for the very disease itself.
Laura?
Yeah, I think that the opposition is entitled to their own opinions, but certainly not their own facts. The facts are very clear that our vaccination rates are low and that we're having community immunity at risk and outbreaks. Look, it's a complicated issue that we're not going to be able to get into completely today, but our coalition of over 60 healthcare organizations, this is InterMed, this is Maine hospitals, every Maine hospital is saying we need to vote no on one. These diseases are dangerous, and this law solves the problem of these diseases.
Let's talk about the specific question, though, vaccine reliability. Right. If a vaccine is not 100% reliable, explain why pediatricians like yourself still want every single child to receive it.
So my sons have received their vaccinations, and I sure hope that they have seroconverted, that meaning that they have the immunity that I was hoping that they would get from that vaccine. But nothing is 100%. Some vaccines, you know, 95-97% effectiveness. And that is why we need to achieve 95% immunity to make sure that we're protecting not only those who cannot receive the vaccine, but also those who have received the vaccine, but are in that very small percentage of individuals that aren't being protected by it.
Brandy, thanks so much for your call. An email from Mark here. Missing from this show is a discussion of risk assessment. Supporters of Yes on One point to anecdotal stories of severe adverse reactions from vaccines, yet there is no discussion of what's the level of risk. If I told you that your risk of being involved in a severe automobile accident is less than your child's risk of severe reaction to vaccines, would you stop driving? Look at the wall-to-wall coverage of COVID-19, yet common influenza kills more people annually. Humans are terrible at assessing risk, and I don't think society should base public health policy on those who demonstrably cannot assess risk. Kara.
I think this is an issue where the person who bears the risk is the individual parent. And so education is always the best way, and collaborative relationships to increase that rate, again, if that's the goal here. But the parent who has a child who has brain swelling after a vaccination and the child is permanently brain damaged, that's the parent who's taking care of that child. It's not the pediatrician. It's not the schools. And so where there's risk with any medical procedure, it should always be choice. We get into a very dangerous place when we as a society are forcing people to take a medical intervention that they are very frequently declining because of that risk that they have calculated themselves.
So you say a child who is brain damaged from having had a vaccination, what is the percentage there? Are we talking 1 in 777,000?
So Patty, I know at the beginning had cited that number in terms of the payouts for the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. There was actually a Harvard study that looked at the incidence of reporting, and they estimated that probably only 1% of vaccine injury is reported, period. So
that vaccine injury is all that serious?
That is not necessarily all that serious. It runs the gamut in severity, but like reactions that rise to the level of needing to be reported are grossly underreported.
Dr. Blaisdell.
You know, vaccine adverse events are so rare that we have trouble finding a number to explain them. You know, that's certainly less than our risk of getting struck by lightning. And we generally say maybe 1 in a million doses. But Kara and I disagree on who is really at risk here. The person who is bearing the risk are those individuals who are immunocompromised, who have cancer, and who no longer can attend school safely. I visited one of our volunteers last weekend. She has an immunocompromised state and cannot receive vaccines. These are the individuals that we are protecting. And I want to remind people, just before I was here, I was at a senior citizens center talking with them about what they remember about these diseases. These are dangerous diseases that we are watching come back because our opt-out rates are skyrocketing. And so we've created a reasonable solution with this law. People who don't want to vaccinate their children don't need to vaccinate. Doctors who believe that children should not get vaccinated are now widely able to protect their patients. And that is why we are urging no on one.
Okay, we're almost out of time, but I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question. I'm going to go to Joel in Lewiston. Hi, Joel, if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Sure, yeah. This question for Dr. B. This new law is rather coercive in nature in that it penalizes a parent for making an informed choice that they believe is best for their child. Last night you stated that you wanted medical exemptions because, and I'm quoting, "I really wouldn't want the government telling me what I can and can't do with my patients." And I agree with you. But if no one side wins, then and parents miss a dose, then and or they don't consent to a dose, then the mandate.
Sure, Joel. Your point is that this would be overly if no one won wins, it's overly coercive. Again, almost out of time, Laura. I'm going to give you about a half a minute, and Kara, about a half a minute as well. Go ahead.
Our decisions, our children's infectious disease risk depends on what our neighbors do, and that's the problem here. Is that now we have gotten to a point that our infectious disease risk is so high in our schools that we need to intervene. We do this with drunk driving. We do this with not smoking in our schools. We can't bring guns to our schools. So there are times when the government needs to step in and limit personal liberties. And parents do, frankly, still have the choice to not vaccinate their child if they don't want to listen to their pediatricians or the over 60 medical organizations and healthcare organizations that have joined our campaign.
All right, Kara.
And I would just add, I think the main voters, it's become clear that we don't have any evidence that unvaccinated individuals or those who are missing a dose of one vaccine are responsible for bringing any issues here in Maine. We have a lot of cases in the news of vaccines, people, who are vaccinated for illnesses who are spreading the disease themselves. This is an overly coercive, horrible law. It's not a middle ground. It is a mandate. It will force parents out of the state because they will have to stay home with their children.
Thank you all both for being here. That's voice you just heard. Kara Sachs, the co-chair for Yes on One. Dr. Laura Blaisdell is here representing No on One. There's much more information, including the reporting done by Patty White and Steve Missler, on our website at mainepublic.org. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.